I don't know how it works in your family. In our family, as we get closer to Christmas, that means a lot more texting between family members. And it's coordination, you know, you're coordinating all the details. It's like, when are you going to be there? And where are we going to do this? And who's buying presents for which kids? And that means we actually have our moms in on the game as well. And so I recently found an app that is really helpful. I don't know if you've run across this before. Because sometimes, I don't know how your mom texts. My mom texts, it can be an adventure. So this is, I found this helpful. Never plays the first time. Really? Technology.
Don't you love technology?
Life is made of moments. It's made of connections. It's made of reaching the ones you love. Whether they're in arm's reach or an interstate away, moms laugh with you, cry with you, and you have no idea how to text coherently.
I love my mom. She just texted me, Aunt Cheryl upstairs, buffalo tortilla.
Mom, I got the job. Confetti horn. Mom, poop, poop, gun, pineapple.
My mom is yelling at me. She doesn't even know it.
She's handed off her phone to an intoxicated toddler.
I ran into your old English teacher. She's divorcing Atlanta.
Unaccounted for autocorrect, emoji nonsense, or a string of words never before seen. Just copy your mom's text into the app, and our patented mom algorithm will gently decipher what she's
saying. Daddy, I'm diaper beans. Thanks to mom text, I now know that he has diabetes.
I still don't understand my mom, but now at least I understand my mom.
No, I can't come help you fix the internet.
Understanding your mom's text means you can get updates about the cousins you don't care about. You can hear the latest about your father's IBS. Pending storm, four states away. Whatever it is, you can now understand your mom's overbearing, passive-aggressive love the way she intends it.
That's brutal. So true.
I love my mom. No, actually, my mom. Yeah, thank you. This is going to be exciting. Yep. No, just love technology.
It has essentially changed the way they think. My kid and my grandkids saw my stocking with my name all in caps.
Uh-huh.
Monogram, and that was in the 80s. That's, it was caps.
That's what you did.
He looked at it and said, why is your name all in caps? He said, it says, Jessica!
I love it. Why is it yelling at me? That is really funny. That was really funny.
Now everybody forever knows
yes. Never forget. All right. I have a very short stool today. We're talking about technology, and so here's where I want to start. Utopia was a term that was coined in 1516 by Sir Thomas More, and it was in a book titled of the same name. And he was describing a society that was that he imagined to be perfect. Here's what the perfect society would be like. You have to wait another 300 years before you get to a different term. And you have to wait 300 years till you get into the Industrial Revolution or post. And through that, you begin to find overcrowded cities, overpopulation, unsanitary and inhumane work conditions, factory work, coal mining. And then because of that, you had government regulation that the world had never imagined before. There was government control trying to change these things, trying to protect people, trying to regulate. And then it was during that time that a new term was introduced, dystopia, which is just the opposite, not too complicated there. And along with that, we actually saw the birth of the dystopian novel. And so in the 1860s, one of the first ones, arguably, The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, imagining a society in the future where you have not just like a hierarchy of sort of like the monarchy and everyone else, but even among like workers, division of labor, those who were going underground to do like the blue collar work, and then those people who are just thinking up above. And then later that leads to other novels, and you can find lists of them in different places. But if you read, you know, your high school reading list, you had 1984 and A Brave New World and others. And then, of course, they take all these and they turn them into movies. So there's been a multiple different variations of a Time Machine made throughout the years. In my lifetime, the few that always stick out to me, The Terminator. This is a very dystopian view of the future. There's an apocalyptic event because of the overrun of machines, of AI. And then you've got Mad Max, all those movies. You've got Blade Runner. And by the way, these are all made in the 80s, and they're still making these movies now. So there's something to them. People really get attached to this image of the world. More recently, you have The Hunger Games, novels that turn into books. I did read these. I did watch them. Divergent, books into movies. I did not read them, and I did not watch them. You also have some just having to do with, like, the environment. So The Day After Tomorrow, this is the end of the world because of global warming. And then pretty much any zombie movie that you've ever seen, most of them have some sort of social commentary. They're highly allegorical in nature. That's kind of where the genre of zombie was birthed out of. And so what's interesting about these movies is that they're not horror movies. Okay, so they're not like The Eye or whatever supernatural thriller that you can imagine. These are supposed to be scary, but in a very different way. Sometimes seriously, sometimes not so much. They're supposed to terrify us, in a sense, because they play to fears that we actually have about the world. So I'm not really that concerned. I mean, most of us probably aren't that concerned about some sort of supernatural, you know, poltergeist moment thing happening. We watch that, or if you do, just to be scared. It's just kind of like this thing that people who watch horror movies just get off on. But this is actually playing to fears that we have in some sense, maybe not zombies specifically, but AI, government, things within society that then make us really, really nervous. And so that's why these movies work. They're giving a vision of the future that we can actually imagine, and in some way is playing to a fear that we actually have. I think, though, that these are good lists, right? There's so many more that we could have added. I want to share with you what I consider to be probably the most terrifying dystopian picture, vision of the future that I've certainly seen in my lifetime. So here it is. Try not to, breathe. It's a terrifying, terrifying movie. Look at those eyes. Now, actually, these guys are the good guys. They're not what's scary. What's scary is the way that humans are depicted in this film. So if you haven't seen, I'm going to give you a little clip, and you can enjoy a bit of WALL-E, which is a great movie.
Well, then what do you want to do?
I don't know. Something.
Bye, Julie.
That sounds good. Okay, you get the idea. Could probably do a whole series just on like a 3-minute clip out of this, because it's fascinating. Like, there's all kinds of implications for even theological implications that we see in that very brief moment. But I want to focus on just one aspect of this. I love the phrase, if you could hear it. I tried to get the volume up loud enough at the very beginning. He says, hey, what do you want to do today? Let's go to the virtual golf range and hit balls. And he says, no, I don't want to do that. We did that yesterday. He says, well, what do you want to do? He says, I don't know, something. This is the essence of leisure, okay? So let me unpack this word leisure a little bit, because it's a kind of a phenomenon of the 20th century. Andy Crouch actually gives us a really helpful distinction between rest and leisure. And so he describes it this way. Think of leisure as fruitless escape from labor. It's a kind of rest that doesn't really restore our souls, doesn't restore our relationship with God or others, and crucially, is the kind of rest that doesn't give others the chance to rest. Leisure is purchased from other people who have to work to provide us our experiences of entertainment and rejuvenation. And so he's making this contrast. He doesn't describe rest a whole lot here, but you can see it implied. Rest for believers, we understand to be a gift from God. So you go all the way back to Genesis 1, and God creates the heavens and the earth, and he works and he creates. And this is a beautiful and good thing that our God does. And then he rests. And in that, he establishes this rhythm and this pattern for life. They were to work and they were to rest. But rest, understand, rest is a time to be, as he says, rejuvenated, to be restored, to have our souls, in a sense, like, I've used rejuvenated and restored, so I'll just use that again, right? It's this idea that we're supposed to reconnect with God, that we're supposed to reconnect with other people, with family. We're supposed to do those things that give us life. And so this is what the Sabbath was intended to be. It was a time to rest from work. I'm not working, but I'm also not lying around doing nothing. Instead, it's a time for me to engage with God. It's to worship. It's to spend time with family. And so in our day, we see this, we take a day of rest, and we think of going to church and we worship God. But we also think of other ways that we worship God, other ways that we engage with the world, with the people around us, and we reconnect through relationship. Maybe we even reconnect with our own souls, going into nature or playing sports or playing music. There's different ways that we can rest that are all part of restoring who we are and who we were created to be as humans. But leisure doesn't do that. Leisure is more a picture of, and I don't want to step on anyone's toes, because I'll certainly do this. I'm not saying that you should never do this. But leisure is sitting on the couch watching football because somebody else is working to provide you entertainment. So that's leisure. Now, leisure, where rest pursues something, and there's an intentionality to rest, that I'm pursuing what will be life-giving and soul-giving for me, whereas leisure pursues, I don't know, something. Okay. Now, if you want to go sort of like trace back this idea of leisure, you can go way, 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 way back. And in the 18th and 19th century, we find a creation myth in the Babylonian Empire of the Enuma Elish. And in it, you've got two main characters. There's actually a bunch of different gods that are involved in this, but there's two. One is Marduk, this guy right here, and this is Tiamat. We think that's who this is depicting. So this is Marduk, and he was like this super Arnold Schwarzenegger warrior guy, okay? And then Tiamat was the goddess who was sort of like the bully of all the gods. All the other gods hated Tiamat. And so they got together and they said, we want to get rid of Tiamat. And so they went to Marduk and said, hey, we want you to kill her. And Marduk said, okay, I'll make you a deal. I will take out Tiamat, but if I do that, you actually have to make me the supreme god over all of you. And so he gets them really drunk and they have a party and they agree to it. So he goes and he uses, I won't go into the detail, but he successfully kills Tiamat. And so he becomes the all-powerful god. And then he looks around and he goes, man, this stinks. We're working awfully hard as gods. We're doing all kinds of things all the time, and if we're gods, we shouldn't have to do all this nonsense. So he says, I have an idea. Let's find some god, and we'll kill him, and we'll take their blood, and we will create humanity. And humanity will be our slave labor. Humanity will do everything that we don't want to do. They'll serve us. And so all the gods looked around and said, we don't like this guy. Hand him over to Marduk. Marduk kills him, and out of his blood, we are born. And so understand that in this picture, humanity is an afterthought of lazy gods. Gods who don't want to work, who want to be waited on, who want to be served, who want leisure. And they go, we're going to create a whole people, our whole creation, that will then will serve us this way. And so this was the prevailing narrative for peoples in the ancient Near East, for much of civilization, for centuries. And whatever was good enough for the gods, well, that would be good enough for us, right? I mean, if it's good enough for the gods to have other people work for them and serve them and so that they don't have to do anything, that sounds like a pretty great dream for me. And so, if I can find my notes here. And so this picture of what it means to be powerful, to be successful, and really to be godlike becomes the prevailing narrative of the day. And actually, it's still entrenched in our human psyches today. That we think of being powerful to be godlike means that we don't have to work. We don't have to do anything. There's other devices. There's other things, if not people, who will work for me to entertain me and to do everything that I want so that I don't have to do it. Okay. And so for many, many centuries, leisure was just an idea. It was kind of a dream. And so you might have like this aristocracy or maybe a monarchy that could actually taste a little bit of this. But today, technology actually makes this available to any of us. Because of technology, we don't have to be super wealthy. We don't have to be the aristocracy. We don't have to be kings and queens. Any of us, because of technology, we actually have something that never could have been imagined or could only be imagined, only dreamed of for many, many centuries throughout human civilization, and that is time to do whatever we want. And we actually have a lot of it. Now, with that, okay, technology makes a... is making a promise to us, okay, that life will be easier. It's going to give us more time, okay? So technology makes time available to us in a way that we never could have imagined before, and it's selling something, right? It's selling, hey, your life will be easier. You will have these tools, these devices that you can use to make housekeeping easier, for example. And there's all kinds of studies that have been done about how housekeeping has been reduced, the amount of time that it takes to clean your house. And it's funny because some of them will say, actually, it hasn't changed that much. But then there's others where people really take advantage of technology. So, for example, there was a study done in 2015 in Britain, and they found that, oh, look at her. Well, I don't know how that happened.
While you're doing that, move away for a second. You're killing me.
She is adorable.
All right, there it goes.
Something's going on there. All right. So in 2015, they did a survey. Okay. I'm just going to kind of keep doing this. Survey. And they found that in Britain, people would spend an average of 63 hours a work housekeeping. Now, they included everything you can imagine in that. Okay. So you're cooking all of your meals and you're cleaning everything. I don't know how that's possible, to be perfectly honest. It said it was per week. I don't know how that's possible. So, was that? You think so? Well, that's how it feels, right? And then, but evidently now it's down to, so that was in 1950s. That was in the 1950s. Uh-oh, I think my, this isn't working. Yeah, I think it's pulling up. It thinks that it's connecting to another... Green.
She's cuter than that
attic. She is. She is. If I move it, what happens? There we go. So here's another one. No pot watching. You can just let it do its thing, and you can be on your landline.
What's a landline?
Yeah, yeah. And then this is great for the holidays, I thought. So I don't know if you can read this. It says... It says, want a please or worth a perfect gift? There's no gift more welcome than electric appliances. So, ladies, if you get a toaster for Christmas, you're welcome. You're welcome. Oh, yeah. Listen, I told Carrie there was. I found a couple that I'm not even showing you. I mean, they were like crazy. Look at this. She's stubborn. This one. Here's another. Yes. Vacuum. Give her a Hoover, and you give her the best. I'm pretty sure my grandmother had this vacuum for years when I was growing up. It was amazing. Thing was a beast, and it would suck up
anything.
The carpet. You know. But technology, right? Technology offers all kinds of great things. Goodness gracious, this is going to be annoying.
I think you're making a technology.
I would say the word technology.
So you're using a Mac.
Stop it. See if this sells. All right. So this is my grandmother's. This is my parents. Yeah.
I love her.
Anybody have that?
So the best was when we were home at Thanksgiving, Eleanor, who keeps making an appearance. So my parents have a laundry room like just off the living room, and it's you know fairly good size. It's got the washer and dryer and some cabinets and stuff in there. And so she crawled in there, shut the door, found the ramen, turned it on, and it chased her around the laundry room, and we could just hear her screams from the other room. She's like trying frantically to get away from it. It's great. I wish I could have had a video of that. All right, so my point being that golly, this is, I'm not happy about this. Somebody. No, I'm doing exactly what, I mean, it's what it always is, yeah.
Start taking it old school.
I know, right?
Drop pictures.
All right. We're going to move to some transparencies next week. Some flannel graph. Yeah. All right. So we got some good news and some bad news. So the good news is that there is so much that technology has certainly contributed to our lives. And housework is easier. Communication is easier. We're more productive. There's all kinds of online tools, and AI does so much in making all kinds. Golly, this is driving me crazy. All right, I'm not sure what to do about this.
F5.
Do what?
Hit the F5
key. Okay.
Just see what happens.
I didn't do it. Function F5. Did that take it off? Okay. All right. Now I'm like really nervous. I'm like, okay. All right. So I want to make sure that we're not. I don't want to overstate. Like I'm trying to say that even in the midst of this series, while we're talking about technology, and there's certain things that we need to be aware of and careful of. There's also all kinds of great benefit, and we all know this, and we take advantage of it all the time. We are able to communicate and stay in contact with people that we wouldn't be able to otherwise. I have friends in Malaysia I can Skype with. My kids can wish grandma and grandpa a happy birthday, you know, at any time. It doesn't matter. If I'm having to work late and I can't tell my kids goodnight, I can get on FaceTime and I can say goodnight to them. You can also create all kinds of beauty through online tools. Whether it's movies or photographs or graphic design, there's all kinds of things that do make our lives richer and more fuller. And this was the promise of technology, in a sense. Technology was saying, look, we're going to give you ways to make your lives easier, but also in that, be fuller and richer. So think of it this way. If technology says, we're going to save you all kinds of time and we're going to make your life easier, then with that extra time, because it's making things so much easier, you will be able to do more. You will be able to accomplish more. You will be able to experience more. You can learn that foreign language. You can stay in better contact with people. You can get more information. And there's all kinds of ways that we use that all the time. But technology also created some other options to us. And that's the bad news, is that while it does create a lot of positives, we can actually work more than ever. Okay, I don't need to belabor this. But suffice to say, technology said, hey, you can be more productive, you can be more efficient, but it used to be if you wanted to leave work behind, you simply left the office. But now it follows you around and it sits in your pocket and says, Bill, you should check your email because there might be something really important. And then you feel like you have to. And so we become chained to our work. So you guys have all experienced that. I think there's the other side of this, though, and that is that we can do nothing. We can do less than something. We can take advantage of the leisure opportunity of technology. So because technology offers us, leisure ends up being a way to never be bored, right? That's the goal of leisure. It's not pursuing something. It's pursuing, I don't know, something. It's pursuing nothing. It's just holding boredom at bay. And so it offers us something that's easy, that's always there. I don't have anything to do for a second. I know, let me scroll through my Facebook feed or my Instagram feed, or let me check scores, or let me actually watch the game while I'm sitting here and I'm waiting for something to happen. I never have to sit there and wonder what I need to do or what could I do. And so in a sense, this becomes a pursuit of nothing. It's a fruitless escape, not just from work, but from life. So C.S. Lewis, in his book, Screwtape Letters, he warns of a particular strategy of Satan. And it's the strategy of nothing. And what he describes is, as the strategy plays out, it leaves a person looking back on their life, lamenting, and I'm quoting here, that I did neither what I ought nor what I liked. It's the pursuit of nothing. And he describes it this way. The pull towards nothing is strong enough to steal away a man's best years, not in sweet sins, but in a dreary flickering of the mind over it knows not what and knows not why, and the gratification of curiosity so feeble that the man is only half aware of them. So you get this picture, and he was writing way before he could never imagine any of this, but I love this dreary flickering of the mind. I mean, just sort of imagine like images flickering past your brain. He goes on, or in the long, dim labyrinth of reveries, I like to call that YouTube, that have not even lust or ambition to give them a relish. In other words, it's not even sin. He's not even like, oh man, I'm after sin, I'm pursuing sin. It's just mindless, just lost in it. But which once chance association has started them. And that's what it feels like when you're on YouTube, right? You're like, hey, this video leads to this video and leads to this video. It's just all random happenstance. They're all just sort of connected through AI algorithms that are telling you what to watch. That's another conversation. Has started them. The person is too weak and fuddled to share off. In other words, you can't stop. You just keep going. She still hasn't appeared?
No.
Man, the F5 right there. Thank you, sir. Seems to be working. Right. So in other words, Lewis warns, there's a type of distracted life, a life that is caught up in diversion, amusement, that doesn't pursue anything of value, not even sin. Sort of like the lukewarm thing here. But will ultimately end with a life without substance, without value, and without presence. And this is the essence of leisure, distractedly looking for the next diversion, the next amusement, something to entertain us, the next curiosity to capture our attention for as long as it can hold it. Which, by the way, isn't all that long. So in the last few years, there's been a number of publications that have talked, including New York Times, Guardian, Telegraph, USA Today, Time Magazine, all of these, have run a study that Microsoft put out. And in the article that was released, Microsoft was making statements about the attention span based on their research. And in it included a statement that actually Microsoft didn't originally have in its report, but basically said that our attention span from 2000, the year 2000, dropped from 12 seconds to, in 2016, 8 seconds, which is less than the 9-second attention span of a goldfish. Now, I've used this a couple of times, and more recently I've discovered that this is probably completely inaccurate, or if nothing else, just sort of made up. So I'm repenting before you that this information that I've shared in the past off the cuff, now having looked into it, it seems somebody just thought that was a fun analogy and thought, hey, it's like a goldfish. Turns out we have no idea what the attention span of a goldfish is. And actually, it's incredibly difficult and maybe even impossible or nonsensical to talk about even our attention span. So when you hear that, myself included, I apologize. There's all kinds of reasons why that doesn't work.
Plus, nobody owns a goldfish. Everybody just has a screensaver of goldfish.
That is true. That is true.
My daughter owned goldfish for a while.
So what's fascinating about goldfish in my little bit of research into this, because I got caught in the diversion of everything, is that is that goldfish actually have memories and they can be trained. I'm not kidding. That's what goldfish experts say. I don't know. Okay. So
trained to do what?
They'll just go for food, you know, it's always food. It's like they're not winking at you or waving, you know. It's sit. You know, that's not happening. Yeah. Look at all its tricks. Play dead. Okay. All right. Now, having said that, even though we may not know exactly what this is doing to our attention spans, there is a question of whether or not this is producing the kind of people that we want to be. If we do have constant distraction, constant diversion, constant amusement, constant new posts all the time, new things to see, new things to read, is this producing, is it possible to become wise just reading through Twitter? See, by Twitter rules, let's think about this. The argument wielding the most memorable, bite-sized, and culturally adept statement wins. In short, the best slogan. And slogans are not designed to be thought of deeply. Like, you don't give a slogan, so when someone sits there and goes, let me think about all the implications of that. No, slogans are supposed to hit you at an intuitive level, like a gut level of like, yeah, I agree with that, or no, I don't agree with that. And so this is not a way to cultivate wisdom. And so if we think about this for our kids, if this is where they're getting a lot of how they view the world and how they process information about what's happening in the world, understand, slogans are not the way to gain wisdom. They don't teach us to think deeply. They don't train us to consider what it actually means. Let me give you one example. I had this conversation with someone recently. I am not making, and I mean this, I am not making a political statement with this. I just picked one that I thought would be convenient, right? Make America great again, okay? Regardless of your political affiliation, this statement has almost a limitless number of meanings. It's just a slogan. How does it hit you? That's all it's doing. So you throw that out there and people go, yes, because it conjures up in their mind from their experience, their biases, this is what that means. And other people go, no, that's terrible because of the opposite. So it's very personalized, this idea of a slogan. So my point here is that this endless flow of bite-sized information, these slogans that are being thrown out to us as a way of processing the world is extremely limited and dangerous. It doesn't produce wisdom, all right? So our attention spans may not be literally shrinking, but they certainly, right, this certainly isn't training us to think deeply and to think wisely. In fact, just the opposite. As Paul warns, you know, we become tossed to and fro by the waves. It's the next breaking wave. Oh, look, I got a new post. And that becomes the latest thing to influence my thinking and my how I see the world. We become products of whatever the last post was. Whether it's from a friend, whether it's off social media, or whether it's the latest breaking news analysis. Okay. And the Pope agrees with me. When media and the digital world become omnipresent, their influence can stop people from learning how to live wisely, to think deeply, and to love generously. In this context, the great sages of the past run the risk of going unheard amid the noise and distractions of an information overload. Tony Reinke, in his book, he puts it this way. The bigger challenge for us in the digital age is not the mental pollution of information overload, but the nutritional deficiency of the content that has been engineered like modern snacks to trigger our appetites. Breaking news, tabloid gossip, viral memes, and the latest controversy in sports, politics, and entertainment all draw us to our phones as if they were deep-fried Twinkies held on sticks at the state fair. Evidently, he lives in Texas. I had no idea. Digital delicacies are eye-grabbing and appealing, but they lack nutrition. All right, quick counterpoint. Can we tweet Proverbs? I mean, they're short. But again, think about what a proverb is. See, it's not just the length. Proverbs are intended to be digested. They're intended to be reflected upon and applied. Slogans are not. And rarely do you find someone who's tweeting Proverbs. Instead, what the psalmist calls us to is so different. This is so different. This is where wisdom is actually cultivated. Listen to how he describes this. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. And on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. So you contrast this with the next verse that I don't have up here, but not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. So the wicked, what are they holding on to? Nothing. So they get driven away. They're tossed to and fro. Why? Whatever the latest thing that comes over that they read. But the man who's blessed, notice the language he used. He meditates. He's planted. He avoids unwise counsel that leads to foolishness. In other words, what he's saying here is be rooted in the Lord so the evil won't be rooted in you. That's this picture here. So it comes down to being rooted in the Lord. This is where wisdom comes from. I think that one of the casualties of the digital age and leisure is part of this, because leisure does not promote wisdom. Leisure doesn't push me to gain wisdom. Leisure is just amusement and distraction. It's diversion from life. It's an escapism. And so one of the casualties then is wisdom. And this is who we are called to be as followers of Christ. And this is what I desperately want for my kids. If they're going to navigate a complex world, they desperately need wisdom. And so in our last few minutes, I just want to think about how do we cultivate wisdom in the digital age and kind of contrast this. One is we have to ground ourselves in Scripture, not popular opinion. And this is the verse I was referencing earlier, Ephesians 4, 13 and 14. It says that we would no longer be infants, right? There's this maturity in play, but we would be mature, no longer infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching, every new analysis that comes over, every tweet, every post, every social media feed, and by the cunning and craftiness of men and their deceitful scheming. And this is instead of popular opinion. You know, when we ride the waves of popular opinion, then we're not wise. Wisdom comes from being grounded in the timeless truth of Scripture, not being blown about by every wind of social outrage or agenda that suddenly becomes in vogue. And that's certainly not to say that there aren't important conversations that we need to have that do come over social media, but we have to have the wisdom to discern them, and even how do we engage them? It's not a matter of simply taking what everyone is giving to you, but taking it to Scripture and saying, what does God have to say about this? So we have to be grounded in Scripture. Because ultimately, we want our kids and for ourselves to be reflections of God, not reflections of our social media feed. Those are two very different things, okay? To be reflections of the Lord and not everybody who I'm listening to. Secondly, we need to fear the Lord and not social media feedback. Proverbs 1:7 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. Proverbs 29:25 says, fear of man will prove to be a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe. And so the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And too often we get caught up in the fear of man. And for teenagers, this is especially critical. For our kids, as they're growing up, this is especially critical. If you have teenagers, you understand this and you see this. That there's such a need for approval. There's such a need to figure out your place in the world. Where do I fit in? Where do I belong? And so we begin to look for, and they look for, and some of us still look for, our place on our phones, in our social media feed. And imagine this for a second, that you have a 24/7 commentary of your status all the time. And how crippling that, and how unhealthy that is. That at any time, you don't just go to school and kind of hear out where you are in the social hierarchy, if you will. Oh, which table do I get to sit in? And then you go home and you're sort of immune from that and isolated from that. But instead, 24/7, you have people commenting, liking, and it's, okay, this is where I stand. This is how popular I am or how unpopular I am. That's unbelievably unhealthy. It's unhealthy for us as adults. It's really unhealthy if you're a kid. And you're trying to find your place in the world. And everyone's telling you don't belong. And it's just like this din of voices all the time. Or they're telling you do and you're amazing. Either one of those is unhealthy. One leads you to constantly trying to figure out, how do I keep my popularity? How do I keep posting things that people will like? How do I keep finding funny videos? Or how do I keep growing this image, polishing this image that I can show to everyone? Or it becomes, how do I hide? How do I escape this? And that leads to all things that we've talked about in the past, whether it's depression or suicidal thoughts. How do we escape? And so we need to teach our kids the fear of the Lord, that it's His opinion that matters. What does He think of you? What does He say of you? And do you believe that? You know, Jesus even warns, watch out when every man likes you, right? This is a danger. In the immortal words of the Counting Crows, I'm going to try to get this right. He says, when everybody loves you, man, sometimes that's just about as messed up as you can be. That's interesting coming from them, by the way. Little history of the Counting Crows, one of my favorite bands. When he first wrote that song, it said the words were the opposite. Basically, when everybody loves you, you'll have arrived. That's what he was singing when he first wrote the song. He rewrote it in a live performance years later and said, when everybody loves you, that's just about as messed up as you can be. He didn't use messed up. That's somebody who figured that out, though. Somebody who learned that. Okay. We need to seek understanding, and we need to encourage our kids to think deeply and not the ease of groupthink. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this next week. But we live in an era of outrage, of gut reactions. Again, that's what slogans are designed to do. They hit us at a gut level and elicit an intuitive response. It's not a thought-out response. It's, how do I respond to this as quickly and as loudly as possible often? And so when and so much of our lives are insulated, right? We live in these echo chambers of other people agreeing with us. Then when someone has the gall to disagree with us or offer a different opinion, then we don't seek to understand. We seek to seek and destroy, basically. All right? And so we need to encourage our kids to think. And this is where, as parents, we have to be engaging with our kids, asking them questions, talking through things. I think sometimes we think that we need to insulate our kids from conversations. And maybe there's a time for that. So there may be like, my three-year-old isn't the time to have a conversation about everything that's going on in the world. And there's some conversations that my nine-year-old may not be ready for. But as they're able, I want to engage my kids and teach them, show them how to think and how to seek understanding. You know, the goal should be to be, so we live in such a divided world right now in society and even within the church. And the reality of that becomes we seek and destroy instead of understand. And that only leads to more and more conflict. And what we need to do is seek to understand. In other words, I want to listen to someone who doesn't agree with me. I want to invite those voices into my life, in a sense, and the right context for my kids especially, and then seek to understand to the point that I can actually express their argument as well as they can. And when I can do that, then there's understanding, right? When I can sit down with someone and say, okay, I think this is what I hear you saying, then there's a place for conversation. There's constructive dialogue rather than simply speaking past one another. And being able to teach my kids to do that and to understand, that creates, this is wisdom, right? This allows them to hear and to understand and to think deeply and then to take it back to Scripture, right? You can't become wise when you don't know what you don't know. And when all we do is listen to everybody who agrees with us, who's yelling slogans that we all get behind, there's very little wisdom in that. Lastly, we need to aim at eternity and not the immediate. We have access to instant information, entertainment, and connection, which in a sense makes everything timeless. It's sort of like everything happens not even within time. It's just, I want this now. And so rather than having to wait ever, and if I have to wait, man, I better entertain myself because that's such an inconvenience. Rather than having to wait, we instantly connect. We instantly get. We can order whatever we want, whenever we want, almost instantly. So there's this instant gratification. But it's not only a matter of instant gratification. There's an immediacy of the digital aid that, in a sense, warps time. And I alluded to this earlier. The constant breaking news reality of 24/7 commentary, social media feeds, its constant notifications don't allow you to live in the moment. And they don't allow you to even have a sense of the movement of time. Everything breaks fresh right then, all the time, all the time, all the time. And so we're caught in this almost always now existence, as though nothing even existed before this moment. One author calls it the little explosions of surprise. And we're waiting for the next explosion. And we welcome them. And so every new piece of information demands immediate attention. Each is as important and as disconnected as the last. See, but wisdom comes when we understand our place in time. That we live in time, and that this life, as believers, we recognize is not the end of the story. In fact, you understand your place in eternity. Until you understand your place in eternity, then you can't live in time the way that God intended. David Gibbons, in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, he explains that until you understand you're going to die and the reality of eternity after that, then you can't live. Only when you have a sense of your place in time in light of eternity, of who God is and who we are in relation to him, are we able to live wisely. And so we need to be teaching our kids that life isn't all about instant gratification, but also that it's not all about what happens right now. It's not about the latest notification that you're going to get. And some of that is learning how to filter what actually does matter. And some of that means turning off notifications, for example, and not being enslaved to those, that immediacy of that demands your attention now. But instead saying, no, there's a time for that, and there's a time for other things. All right, last thing. So if you go back to Marduk, he creates humanity because he needed slave labor. They wanted to not work, but instead they wanted to enjoy leisure. And so they were only going to be served, and they're going to be waited on. But see, Genesis tells a very, very different story. It tells a story of God who does himself work. He gets his hands in the dirt and he makes us. He creates us, but he makes us in his image. He doesn't make us to be his slaves. He makes us to be his children. He doesn't make us so that he'll be waited on, but instead he creates us to work because work is good. And he creates us to rest because rest is good. And he creates us to look like him. And what looking like him looks like isn't being waited on, but is actually waiting on others. In fact, all of this is culminates in the person of Christ. And Jesus says, I didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. And this is the picture of what it means to be godlike. This idea to be godlike means that my devices and even other people work for me so that I can enjoy leisure that does not promote wisdom is actually the antithesis of what it means to be godlike. To be godlike means to enter into the world, to be present, to be fully engaged, to serve others, and to give our lives for the sake of others. And to do that, it doesn't look like leisure, but it does need wisdom. It takes tremendous wisdom to enter into the world and to know how to respond to so many things that are happening and being thrown at us all at one time. And we do live in an age of immediacy. We live in the digital age where things are being thrown at us constantly. There is new information, new updates, new breaking news all the time. And so we must think about how do we, in the light of that, move our kids towards wisdom, to fear the Lord, to be grounded in Scripture, to consider their lives in light of eternity. And what does it actually mean to be godlike? It means to look like Jesus.